WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. It's Friday, March 31st, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. We've got a great show today. In a little bit, we'll be showing an interview with a man who believes COVID hospital protocols killed his young daughter, and he's just filed a lawsuit against the Wisconsin hospital where she died. Now, let's dive in. We have lots to cover. So for the last few years, establishment media organs have constantly bombarded the public with news of growing extremism on the right. They throw out words like far right, radical, and extreme, like candy in a small town parade. Pretty much anything left of Mitt Romney and Lindsey Graham has become far-right extremism. Many times, major media mouthpieces say the right's extremism is a result of growing belief in conspiracy theories. Oh yes, that most leprous label, conspiracy theorist. Just in the last couple of weeks alone, the parent organization of the New American magazine, the John Birch Society, has been blamed for ushering extremism, far-rightism, into the establishment GOP. They blamed the JBS for spreading conspiracy theories. Now, the label of conspiracy theorist is intended to be a stigma, a weapon to discredit the poor soul or souls hit by it. And it's supposed to discourage anyone who dares to think outside of the approved narrative. But like with so many other attacks of the propaganda media, labeling half the country conspiracy theorists is proving ineffective. People are realizing this pejorative is the establishment's way of trying to shut down a conversation they don't want you to have. So let's look at a few conspiracy theories that turn out to be very credible and finish with one that is so true that if completely accomplished, it would destroy life as we know it. We'll start out with a drop in the bucket of conspiracy theories. In some of the articles I recently mentioned on the JBS, they labeled us conspiracy theorists for opposing mass water fluoridation back in the day before it was implemented nationwide. During the 50s and the 60s, the JBS, through our affiliate magazine, American Opinion, opposed mass fluoridation on the grounds that it was collectivized medicine and that there was no expert consensus that it wasn't harmful. It turned out we were on to something all along, because on March 15, 2023, the National Toxicology Program released a draft report linking prenatal and childhood fluoride exposure to reduced IQ in children. Furthermore, the report found that there is also some evidence that fluoride exposure is associated with other neurodevelopmental and cognitive effects in children. The peer review report took 6 years to complete. And if it were up to the corrupt Department of Health and Human Services and the CDC, we would have never seen the report. It took a lawsuit by Food and Water Watch to get it released. So much for that baseless conspiracy theory. Now, let's look at another one from not too long ago. Remember when people began realizing that COVID-19 had likely come out of a lab and not from bats? Here are some of the propaganda media's biggest stars channeling their inner epidemiologist.
Tom Cotton, a couple of days ago, spouting a conspiracy theory that the Chinese made this virus up.
You have the lab in Wuhan.
In a lab. You have Rush Limbaugh every day, Presidential Medal, Freedom of Honor. It's hard to say this is the most reckless thing he's ever done.
Those same agencies now have been tapped with investigating one of Trump world's most favorite conspiracy theories. New York Times reports this, quote, senior Trump administration officials have pushed American spy agencies to hunt for evidence to support an unsubstantiated theory that a government lab in Wuhan, China was the origin of the coronavirus outbreak.
Tom Cotton, one of Donald Trump's staunchest allies in the Senate, suggested that the virus might have originated in a high-security biochemical lab in China. In the 1980s, I remember when the far left trafficked in rumors about HIV having been invented in CIA labs. The far right has now found its own virus conspiracy theory.
Well, it turns out that 3 years later, that conspiracy theory has become the most likely explanation on the origins of COVID-19. Let's watch Senator Tom Cotton, whose op-ed in the New York Times in 2020 nearly led to a mutiny at the snowflake-ridden nation's paper of record.
From the very beginning, I believe this virus almost certainly came from a lab. I thought it was just a matter of common sense. You didn't need secret intelligence or classified information just to look at the facts. You had a food market that the Chinese communists were saying was the source of the virus. They didn't even sell bats in an area where bats were not located. And then you had a laboratory where they were known to focus and work with bat-based coronaviruses that had a history, like many Chinese labs, of safety incidents. Again, to me, it was just a matter of common sense. But what did the liberal media and what did Joe Biden and other Democrats do? When you point these things out, they called you a racist or a xenophobe. They said you were spreading conspiracy theories and all the rest. And now, you know, 3 years on, I think most Americans recognize that it almost certainly came from that laboratory, that the Chinese communists covered it up, and that you still have the liberal media and Democrats acting like lawyers for Chinese communists, trying to excuse them, trying to say, well, there's not much consensus. We're not know for sure, much like they did a couple weeks ago when China sent a spy balloon to America.
Now, let's look at another conspiracy theory that is unfortunately becoming reality in real time. When the COVID-19 injection was rolled out, the New American published leading experts who warned it would not be safe and effective.
I wouldn't want anybody to get the vaccine and think that they're being protected against COVID-19. In the United States today, we have approximately 77 million individuals fully vaccinated, and we have 2,602 deaths, 2,602 deaths. So it's unprecedented how many deaths have accrued.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination. You are heading for the greatest catastrophe in your history.
So what did the scientists moonlighting as news reporters and philanthropists call these people raising the alarm?
As President Biden's COVID-19 vaccine effort ramps up, religious-based conspiracy theories surrounding the vaccinations are exploding on social media.
The anti-vaccination movement is growing, and more children are getting sick, really sick, due to a new wave of conspiracy theories that have been shared through social media.
I hope it goes away. I hope it doesn't hold back, you know, mask wearing or seeking out vaccines. The percentage that's really misled by these conspiracy theories, it's unclear to me. There's millions of messages out there, you know, where my name or Dr. Fauci's name is used, but
unfortunately, it wasn't a conspiracy theory. It's become a reality for people all over the world. In 2021, just months after the injection rolled out, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, was already reporting astronomical spikes of adverse effects. Then, early in 2022, a report from life insurance group One America revealed that all-cause mortality rates of working people aged 18 to 64 increased by 40% over the second half of 2021. The CEO of One America, J. Scott Davidson, called it a staggering amount.
And we are seeing right now the highest death rates we have ever seen in the history of this business, not just at One America. The data is consistent across every player in that business. Now, this is primarily working age people, 18 to 64, that are in employers like all the employers on the screen here. And what we saw just in third quarter, we're seeing it continue into fourth quarter, is that death rates are up 40% over what they were pre-pandemic.
Dr. Robert Malone, an inventor of the mRNA technology and a leader in the medical freedom movement, called the news, quote, a nuclear truth bomb masquerading as an insurance agent's dry manila envelope full of actuarial tables, unquote. Well, that's a mouthful. With the cat out of the bag and threatening to escape the house, mainstream media quickly went to work, laying cover for the injection by saying this anomalous spike was a result of the Delta variants and deferred medical care during the pandemic. Except that this age group was not the 70 and over that accounted for an overwhelming majority of COVID deaths, and it didn't explain one other phenomenon. We were beginning to see regular reports of the strangest thing, young people, and not just young people, but athletes, dropping dead of heart attacks. Expert statistician and former BlackRock manager Edward Dowd published a book titled Cause Unknown, The Epidemic of Sudden Deaths in 2021 and 2022, which included 25 pages of news headlines on the deaths of young people. Here are a few recent tragic headlines related to this development. Unfortunately, we can keep going, but you get the point. It's become tragically obvious that the injections are not safe and effective. And furthermore, it looks like they can be downright deadly. Here is the Surgeon General of Florida being a conspiracy theorist.
These vaccines have a terrible safety profile. At this point in the pandemic, you know, I'm not sure anyone should be taking them.
And let's look at our last conspiracy theory, the granddaddy of them all. For at least a few hundred years, men possessed by the desire to rule the world have been secretly plotting to do just that. Generations of these men, insiders we call them, have worked in secret to make this happen. The insider strategy to bring about their one-world tyrannical government can be summarized with a few broad goals. They work to destroy all religion, to destroy all existing sovereign governments, and to destroy all traditional human institutions. And the main weapons to make this happen include war, which they foment and then exploit to bring about changes the public wouldn't normally stand for, money, which they use to influence public policy in a way that makes them richer and regular people poorer, hatred, which they incite by funding people and organizations that sow division, and then they weaponize their control over media and education institutions to attack religion and family. The idea is to eradicate the main glue that holds the current order together, that being the traditional family and God. You don't need 2020 vision to see this is happening. One blurry eye will do. While most people haven't believed or known of this conspiracy, it hasn't been a carefully guarded secret either. In 2003, David Rockefeller, former chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote in his biography, quote, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it," unquote. Former Georgetown University professor Carol Quigley, whose students included President Bill Clinton, wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time. He admitted not only that such a conspiracy existed, but that he knew this because he studied it for 20 years and he was allowed for two of those years to look at its papers and secret documents. He explained that the powers of financial capitalism had a far-reaching plan, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. In 2020, we began seeing what this world would look like. When COVID-19 was unleashed on the world, nearly every government in the world, at the behest of the international governing body, the World Health Organization, implemented the same destructive, freedom-crushing edicts. From lockdowns to mandatory masking to injection coercion, the world as a whole was equally terrorized. This continued happening to varying degrees, even after it became obvious that COVID wasn't as harmful and that the so-called mitigation measures were causing more harm than the disease. It was at this time that we began noticing the globalists at the World Economic Forum, a collection of bankers and corporate plutocrats working with governments. These aspiring Napoleons worked to destroy the current order so they could piece the rubble back together according to their fascist, communist, technocratic model. They saw this as the opportunity to foist upon the world the final pieces of their global government. Here is Yuval Noah Harari, a mouthpiece for the globalist, saying in 2017, before COVID, that a catastrophe would probably be the only way to bring about a world government.
One option that some people talk about is that only a catastrophe can shake humankind and open the path to a real system of global governance. And they say that we can't do it before the catastrophe, but we need to start laying the foundations so that when the disaster strikes, we can react quickly.
And the technocrats at the World Economic Forum were already laying the conditioning groundwork for the slavish system they wanted to impose on us. Notice that while they said that you will own nothing, they didn't say who will own everything. The answer, of course, is they will. our benevolent, all-wise, and powerful masters. The collaborative global response to COVID was unprecedented. From lockdowns, to masking, to suppression of effective cheap drugs, to the tyrannical push for universal injection, and to the vital role of regime propagandists the media played, there has never been such a large and successful campaign of tyranny. The cooperative COVID response was no accident. They were ready for this. They had been practicing. They were ready to use this catastrophic virus as an excuse to turn you into a serf. Here's cartoonish yet all too real villain WEF head Klaus Schwab letting you know that the future is one world government.
Our futures are intrinsically connected to one another as profound challenges to mankind, such as climate change, are globally interconnected and require collaborative responses. In conclusion, and despite all the challenges, we have to uphold our responsibility, which we have towards the next generation, and which we can only fulfill through collaboration on a national and on a global level.
The quest for global government is not a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy fact. It is happening as I speak. The John Birch Society was founded exactly for such a time as this. We were founded to expose this plan and to stop it. Our founder, Robert Welch, founded the JBS to restore liberty. Here's Welch quoting from his speech at the founding meeting in 1958.
In the 20th century, modern man is simply being played for a sucker by an immoral gang of sophisticated criminals. These cunning megalomaniacs seek to make themselves the absolute rulers of a human race of enslaved robots in which every civilized trait has been destroyed. The insiders at the top and all their communist minions constitute only a tiny percentage of the race they plan to rule. Although they now occupy most of the positions of great prestige and influence in Washington and London and Paris, as well as in the financial, educational, and publishing circles of the whole world, their power rests entirely on bluff, pretense, and deception. Both their success and their purposes are contrary to the whole current of human history. They are sitting precariously on the gigantic powder keg of all honest human emotions. Despite their arrogant assurance on the contemporary scene, they themselves are well aware that sooner or later, the whole framework of their cruel power will be blown to pieces by a mighty uprising of the incalculable forces of man's moral principles, love for freedom, and common sense. How soon that day of delivery may come will depend on you.
So joining me to discuss this is editor-in-chief of The New American, Gary Benoit.
Hello, Paul.
Hey, Gary.
As you can see, I came dressed appropriate for the occasion because you had asked me to be on your program to talk about conspiracy theory.
Yes, and you came in a tinfoil hat.
And I came in a tinfoil hat. For all I knew, you wanted to talk about maybe cheese on the moon, a moon made of green cheese, or perhaps the biggest whopper of all might be the claim that President Trump was actually put in the White House by Putin. Can you imagine a more ridiculous conspiracy?
Yes.
But I want you to know, Paul, that I'm really relieved to know that we're not going to be talking about conspiracy theory. So I'm going to get rid of this.
Oh, thank goodness.
We're going to be talking about conspiracy fact, because there is a huge difference. And conspiracy fact is what the John Birch Society and what the New American Magazine specialize in. And we don't have much time right now, but I want to recommend this book, Endgame, COVID and the Dark State Quest for Bio-Digital Convergence in a Transhumanist World.
Right.
By the publisher of the New American,
Dennis
Barrent.
Yes.
And we'll have an ad regarding this book at the break coming up very soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage everybody to read this book, because this is all based on conspiracy fact. It shows how what has happened with COVID, the lockdowns, the forced medication, The precursor, which, as you mentioned, was fluoride. That was forced medication by putting that in the water supply.
Right.
And now people supposedly are not going to be allowed to have a choice between whether or not they get something injected into their bodies. And
right.
All this fits together. And again, it's conspiracy fact. The evidence is overwhelming. And, of course, it all points to control. Control of what? Control of everything.
Right.
As you pointed out in a cursory way in what you had in your presentation, which was excellent, Paul. It leaves me with very little to say.
Are you sure? You know, you've been the editor for The New American for so many years, and you've been at the helm while we publish so much information. Any last words for those watching and who may not be sold on the conspiracy fact that of a plan for one world government?
Well, I think the way to sell it is to point out that we've been saying this from the very beginning. When Robert Welch founded the John Birch Society in 1958, he warned then about this organized plan, this organized
right.
conspiracy. At the time was mostly manifested in the form of communism, but he also talked about the conspiracy above communism, the insiders, the elitists who worked with the communists
right.
because they supported the same thing,
the
which was
conspiracy.
Total monopolistic control over everything. And back then, when we warned the town and told the people and got people involved, a lot of people did not believe it.
Right.
But more and more people are believing it today because it's become so open. The word conspiracy almost does not fit anymore.
Yeah, we're always debating that.
Right.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for all the work that your team and that you've put for all these years. And we hope that that it's paid dividends. And thank you for your time.
It is. And thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you for tuning in, and we will be right back on the other side of this break.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber, and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the Singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, E-N-D-S-H-I-P. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Yesterday, The New American attended a press conference during which Scott Scherer announced he was taking legal action against St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Appleton, Wisconsin, including the doctors and nurses involved in the case connected to his daughter's death. For those of you unfamiliar with the case, on October 13, 2021, Grace Scherer, a 19-year-old girl who was hospitalized with COVID, died while under the care of the hospital, which was following the COVID-19 protocols. We're now going to show you two clips from the news conference. In the first clip, Scott Scherer describes what happened to his daughter. This will be immediately followed by a clip of Jessie van der Heijden, Scott's daughter, and Grace's older sister, who was in the hospital room with Grace when she died.
What happened with Grace was she had low oxygen saturation, low defined differently than what we know today. So on October 6th of 2021, her oxygen saturation was hovering 88-89%. Unfortunately, we perceived that as an emergency because we were following the FLCCC protocol. And I'm not throwing that protocol under the bus at all. What I'm doing is throwing myself under the bus for following it without thinking. One of the things on the protocol is to get a pulse ox. And a pulse ox measures your oxygen saturation. And they suggested in the protocol, if that number goes below 94%, go to the emergency room and admit yourself to the hospital. So we did that. And the mistake is trusting, first we weren't trusting the white coat, but then we trusted a different white coat instead of trusting ourselves. And we did not have a baseline for a pulse ox. So we had no business even recording the number. If we would have had a baseline before, we would have probably seen Grace was in the 80s every time she was sick before, and we would have thought that was normal. But ultimately, that decision started a series of events in motion that ended with Grace's death on October 13th of 2021. And I'm going to just hit a couple high points. So October 6th, we went to the urgent care on Richmond Street in Appleton. And they recommended, because Grace had a high D-dimer score, which is a blood chemistry parameter, that we should go via ambulance to St. Elizabeth's Hospital emergency room right down the road. So I rode in the ambulance with Grace. She was fine. She was giving me the thumbs up in the ambulance. We were just joking around. We got into the emergency room, and the emergency room physician, after a CT scan, which was negative, suggested admitting Grace into the hospital. So I said, well, I'll be staying with her. And they immediately said, you can't. They said, well, then I'll be taking Grace home. And after 2 hours of deliberation, they decided and came back into the room and said, we decided you can stay as long as you don't leave the room. So that was an easy condition. And so I stayed from October 6th until 8 o'clock in the morning on October 10th. And at that time, I was taken out of the room by an armed guard. And I was taken out because I was challenging things that I saw were wrong. Then we had to hire an attorney to be able to get my daughter, Jessica, who you just heard from, in the room to replace me as an advocate. Cindy couldn't do it at that time because she was sick. So after 44 hours of nobody in the room with Grace, Jessica was finally in the room, and she was with Grace her last 2 days on this earth. Grace's second to last day, October 12th, was such a good day that when Grace sat up in bed the evening of the 12th, she sat up, Jessica called her two boys who are here today, Caleb and Riley, Grace's nephews, that Grace sat up in the bed and hollered to them through a BiPAP, hi boys. And Jessica monitored her oxygen level that entire night before, and it was at 98% and 99%. The next morning, we received a call from the doctor, Cindy and I, and he wanted our decision on whether we would give the hospital a pre-authorization to put Grace on a ventilator. So this was the fifth request. So a pre-authorization means we would pre-approve that ventilator, and they framed it just in case. And just in case, these type of things tend to happen in the middle of the night when we can't get a hold of the family. So they wanted us to pre-approve a ventilator. We already knew we weren't going to do a ventilator because a ventilator has a 90% kill rate. So when we said no, when he called that morning of the 13th, he immediately switched gears and said, Grace had such a good day yesterday, we should work on nutrition. And he convinced us that a feeding tube was the best nutrition, even though Grace had a central line and could have been fed TBN food. The series of events I'm going to tell you next, you can't make up. So what happened next, Jessica was in the room at this time with Grace, and she said to the nurse that Cindy referenced when she talked that she's going to take a shower. There's a shower in the room. That nurse insisted that Jess would not be able to take a shower in the room. If she wanted to take a shower, she needed to go home. So Jess objected and said, well, when my dad was in the room, he could take a shower in the room. And she said, I don't care what we did for your dad. You need to go home and take a shower. So Jessica talked with Grace. Grace was okay with that. When she got back, inside of an hour, she overheard two doctors and this nurse in the hallway say the family's not gonna like this. So remember, we had just talked with the doctor. And so she said, what aren't they going to like? She said, we had to restrain Grace while you were gone. So she said, what's the reason? Well, Grace wanted to get out of bed and go to the bathroom. And instead of helping her out of the bed to go to the bathroom, they restrained her. In that call with the doctor, interestingly, he said, we're gonna get Grace out of bed today in a chair. You know, she's doing that well. But yet, when push came to shove, they strapped her down to the bed instead of helping her out. They used that as an excuse to increase a dose of sedation med called Presidex to a near lethal dose. 14 times the dose that they started her on 4.5 days earlier that we were unaware of. If you look at the package insert for Presidex, it says specifically to not use for more than 24 hours because if you do, it causes acute respiratory failure. And if you look at Grace's death certificate, the first cause of death is truthful. It says she died of acute respiratory failure. Well, that was inflicted by the hospital's decision. At 11:25, after having Grace on this near-lethal dose of Presidex, they gave her a dose of lorazepam. At 5:46, they gave her another dose of lorazepam, and at 5:49, another dose of lorazepam, and at 6:15, they gave her morphine as an IV push. So in 29 minutes, she had Presidex, lorazepam, and morphine in her system. If you're not familiar with those drugs, that's what they give hospice patients during the last half hour of their life. No one could have survived that med combination. And that's the true second cause of Grace's death, even though the death certificate says COVID-19 pneumonia. The package insert for morphine says if you combine those drugs, they can cause death. And it's a risky combination. Those drugs are contraindicated. After they gave Grace the morphine at 6:15, no doctor or nurse stepped foot in the room, in spite of Jessica's pleas for them to help. My sister's getting cold. The nurse said, just cover her with a blanket, that's normal. Jessica called Cindy and I panicking at 7:20. In the same day, less than half a day after we talked with the doctor, telling us Grace had such a good day. She called us panicking and said, Dad, Grace's numbers are dropping like crazy. I said, get the nurses in. She said, they won't come in. She estimated 30 nurses in the hallway at this point because of shift change. So we started screaming through the FaceTime call, Cindy and I, save our daughter. And they hollered back, she's DNR, do not resuscitate. And we hollered back, she's not DNR, save our daughter. They refused to come in the room. And we watched Grace die 7 minutes later on a FaceTime call at 7:27 on October 13th. We found out afterward, after reviewing the records, that the doctor put the DNR order on Grace simultaneous with hanging up the phone with us that morning. Last but not least, when we talked with Jessica later on that evening, she told us that there was an armed guard posted outside of Grace's room. thankfully, when our pastor was walking Grace or walking Cindy out, the nurse leaned down to Cindy on the way out with Grace's belongings on a cart and said, "Mrs. Shera, me and several of the nurses don't think Grace should have died today." And that statement started a whole series of investigations, forensics work, doors opening, and that's where we're here today.
Grace was a loving daughter, sister, aunt, niece, and friend. We all love and miss her more than words could ever explain. She always thought of others, enjoyed life, and truly showed God's love through her actions. Her precious life was stolen at a hospital by medical staff, by the very people who we were taught to trust. She had just celebrated her 19th birthday. I was there with Grace during her last days on this earth. I was there when a doctor chose to put an illegal do not resuscitate order on my sister without family knowledge or consent. I was there when they chose to overdose her on sedatives and narcotics illegally, once again, without family knowledge or consent. Grace was given a drug combination that none of us would have survived. Even though I was right there next to her, I was unaware of these things, and I would have never thought they were there to kill her. I was there when we screamed and begged the doctors and nurses to save her. I was there when her soul left her body and she was ushered into heaven on October 13th, 2021. Today marks an important chapter in our lives. This chapter to me is the fight for justice. We not only hope and pray that justice will come for Grace, but also for the hundreds of thousands of lives stolen by this medical tyranny. These crimes against humanity must stop. They need to be held accountable for their actions. From the very beginning of speaking out, I've always had this thought that God was going to use Grace for something much bigger than we could ever imagine. Could Grace be the face that takes them all down? Only God knows. What I do know is they took one of God's, and I truly believe he has bigger plans in the days ahead. I pray we all stay strong and we glorify God in what we all are doing. This world is so very corrupt and evil, and I can't wait to be reunited with Grace and our brother Travis in that heavenly bliss Grace talked about often. Until then, we have a mission that God has put us on. We must remember God has a plan through all the hurt and pain, and he has it all worked out already. God's got this. One very important thing that Grace has taught me is to have faith, and that's what we need to do. Our loved ones just beat us home is all, to our heavenly home, and the day we are called home and are all together again will be the greatest day. Grace did not die in vain. We are standing on Genesis 50:20. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. We appreciate all your prayers and support. Thank you.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family. Perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Does your family have an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand? With all that's going on in the world today, why would you not? We have attacks on our power grid, our banking system. We have the actual threat of a banking collapse. Of course, people are talking World War III, chemical spills, and so much more. I've had an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand for my family since 2013. And then we began offering it to our audience as a service to them. But it's also a big part of our general operating budget. So thank you for purchasing it from us. We can help you and you can help us. We all win. So let me tell you about it. You can order it right now and get free freight. We're offering free freight. For some of you, that's going to save you hundreds of dollars because you're ordering a one-year supply and a two-year supply. And we're offering free freight. So you can order it at WVWTVstore.com. That's WVWTVstore.com. You can also call and talk to someone over the phone, and they'll answer all your questions and take your order, track it all the way to your front door. That number is 901-468-9357. We have the gluten-free kit right here available, and it comes in the individual pouches of the individual entrees. Easy to make, easy instructions to follow. We have a 3-month, 6-month, 1-year, 2-year mega protein kit with real meat and the ultimate breakfast program as well. All the details, WVWTVstore.com. It has a 25-year shelf life, as I said, but we offer more than just freeze-dried food. We offer also emergency supplies. We've thought about the things you're going to need should the power go out or there's a crisis, like a little stove. All you need is a little bit of kindling, start a fire, use that stove, and then the custom pot goes on top to boil the water. We also have the water purifiers, as well as hand crank and solar radios and flashlights. Everything's available for you to check out now at WVWTVstore.com or using the number on our screen. Thank you.
After yesterday's news conference with Scott Shera, he came to the New American Studio here in Appleton, where he was interviewed by our own Christian Gomez. Let's watch the interview.
This is Christian Gomez with the New American Magazine, and joining us right now here in the studio is Scott Shera, the father of Grace Shera. Scott, thank you for joining us again here at the New American.
Well, thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
So earlier today, we're recording this on Thursday, March 30th. So earlier on Thursday, March 30th, which for us is today, you had a press conference right down the street from St. Elizabeth's Hospital in which you announced a lawsuit that you will be proceeding with, filed on the 30th of March against St. Elizabeth Hospital in Ascension. Can you tell us a bit about the case and how you got from how you got to where we are today?
Sure. I mean, the fact that we're filing is really a miracle because the state statutes really preclude any of this from ever happening. So Grace was a legal adult. She was 19 when she was killed. And what happens is the state statutes say, because she was an adult, Cindy, my wife, and I have no claim. So just in order to file, we had to open up an estate for Grace because you would think that there would be the ability to file, but it just says an adult, you can't file against an adult for emotional distress and loss of companionship, all those things. So we had to literally open up an estate. And so then what ends up happening is you've got to spend money with the legal team to do that, and then there's no recovery because Grace was a legal adult. So when you actually see the complaint that gets filed, I don't want to go into that detail right now, but you'll see that, you know, basically we can get our funeral expenses back. So we knew at the beginning this was never about money. That's not the goal here. We're trying to get this case out to expose evil. And as part of that, we have named individual doctors and nurses who breached the standard of care so that other doctors and nurses across the country see that there are real consequences to the choices. You can't just choose to take somebody out. There's consequences.
Now, this is huge because several months ago when I last spoke with you, I had even asked you if you had thought that you would be able to proceed with the lawsuit in the future at some point, and you weren't sure. And at the time you were doing, and you still are doing actually, the billboards. You have about 18 of them, I think it is, right. In the Fox Valley area in northeast Wisconsin, bringing attention to what happened to your daughter, Grace. So now it seems as though you will be proceeding with the litigation. So what is the process of going forward now? So on Thursday, the 30th of March, filed in Madison. So what happens next?
That's a great question. So they make it near, you know, again, under the guise of not wanting, you know, to protect the doctors and really not wanting anybody to sue, they make you jump through a hoop. So the hoop that got filed today, I'm going to pull it up here. We filed with the director of state courts. So what happens is anytime there's a claim against a hospital or medical system, the state statute requires you to, before you can hear the civil case in court, you have to go through a mediation process by statute. So we filed with the director of state courts today. That director has 7 days to appoint a panel, and then that panel has 90 days to hear the case. So then it's like a mini case. And so then they make a non-binding recommendation. So then both the hospital and us can choose to not accept that recommendation and go forward. So then the civil case, so we'll be filing the civil case within the next couple of weeks. We've got all the pleadings done, but they just have to go through the review process. So that's the real meat of the case. And so I just want to read right out of the pleadings. So the nuts and bolts of the case, so there's five different components of the case. There's a wrongful death component. There's the, of course, medical malpractice, right? They over-sedated Grace. They put an illegal DNR. There's an intentional medical battery, and that's because we didn't get any informed consent relative to what they're doing. There's a negligent intent to commit emotional distress towards us. So, I mean, obviously it's an emotional situation. And then maybe the most important for other people is a declaratory judgment relative to the illegal DNR, because that's really, you know, if you think about the way, so I was on with Rebecca previously, and I explained how the Department of Professional and Safety, who regulates the doctors and nurses, they gave an opinion that Chapter 154 of the Wisconsin state statutes, which is the DNR statute, they gave an opinion that that statute does not apply to hospital settings. So, I mean, this is in the idea. My brother always says, you always say this, Scott, you can't make this up. So think through it. If the DNR statute doesn't apply to a hospital setting, which that's the opinion of the department that regulates the doctors, that means if you're in a hospital setting, you really have to have your laptop up on your bed live watching your chart, because the doctor can put a DNR on you anytime. Well, obviously, we have got to stop that. And so that's the fifth component of the civil case, is a declaratory judgment for the illegal DNR.
And that's what's in part so historic about this case, because this is the first of its kind, correct?
Correct.
And if successful, this could lead to many more cases to allow the loved ones of those who've lost their relatives in similar circumstances to get the justice that they have not yet received. Because in this situation, no one has been brought to justice, correct, with regards to the doctors, nurses. They're still all, as far as we know, fully employed and enjoying life to the fullest.
Well, that's why we're not waiting the, in theory, 97 days for this director of state courts to make the decision. We're filing the civil case, even though the civil case can't be heard until that mediation process is done. We're filing the civil case in the next 2 weeks, because we want that civil case will become public record, so anybody can look it up. And that creates a model for other people to file in the counties that they live in other states, because people don't know what the pleadings need to look like to win. So we hired a firm out of Ohio. The attorney that was there today was from Wisconsin, but the main legal firm is out of Ohio, and they're used to fighting cases at that are national cases like this.
So who are the names in this case, and what exactly are the specifics surrounding it?
So what's being filed today is this motion for the director of state courts to start with mediation. And we have seven people named, five doctors and two nurses. So we have Gavin Shokar. He's the one who put the DNR on Grace. David Beck. These are all MDs, these first five. Daniel Leonard, Carl Baum, Ramana Miranda. And then we have two nurses, Holly McGinnis, who is the 14-year ICU nurse. She's the one who gave Grace the meds. And then Allison Burkholz. And she's was the head nurse that had me escorted out by an armed guard. So those are the seven people listed. There's also, we have a list of John Doe's, because what happens when you're in a case, realize we don't have all the records yet. So what happens when you get involved in a case, you have an opportunity to amend and add people that you didn't know breached something at the time that you filed. So then we have the John and Jane Doe listed also. And then what we had to specifically write with this, finally with the director of state court. So here's the question that they pose, and I'll answer it then. It says, the condition or disease for which the healthcare provider was treating Grace when the negligence occurred and the dates of treatment. So that was an answer we had to provide for this filing. Here's the answer. Low oxygen saturation, viral infection, pneumonia, conditions secondary or created thereafter under the hospital's care from October 6th through the 13th, 2021, including acute hypoxic respiratory failure. Additionally, Gavin Shokar, MD, wrongfully placed a do not resuscitate order on Grace.
What do you hope happens to the doctor if your case ends up going to court and as you plan to file? And if it is successful, what do you hope to happen to specifically that doctor who placed the do not resuscitate order on Grace?
Well, you know, the most important thing that I hope that happens to him is that his heart changes. Because if that man repents, we won. So that's the most important thing. So, you know, why hasn't he done that yet? I don't know. I mean, I don't know him. I mean, but, you know, this type of thing might lead him towards that end. I don't know. If it doesn't, you know, I would expect that, you know, he's going to lose his license. This should turn into a criminal case. I mean, so, you know, he should end up with jail time. I mean, that's what should happen. I don't know what's going to happen. It's not my job to determine what the consequence is. But I mean, obviously, when you kill somebody or you put in motion the things to kill somebody, there should be a consequence. You know, as Jessica, my daughter, has said many times, if somebody is on the street and they shoot somebody, they instantly lock them up. They don't let them keep shooting until there's a court case, right? So now you have a doctor who he thinks this is okay. So you know it's continuing to happen. So I mean, we've got to stop the behavior. And it's not going to be us that does it. And that's why we listed the individual doctors and nurses in the complaint, because we want people to know across the country that there are consequences for choices. And so you don't just list the hospital. There's no consequences. You know, Ascension Hospital System has $30 billion in cash reserves. So what consequence is it to them? You have to have individual doctors and nurses see that they're held to account for their actions. That's how we can stop this behavior, and that's the goal.
What are the next steps with the case?
Yeah, so like we filed the petition with the director of state courts today. All right, so that was hand-delivered in Madison. So that starts the clock ticking. So hopefully it doesn't take the full 97 days with what they have. Roughly two, it might be as fast as a week, but we'll file the complaint / pleadings with the Outagamie County Court. And so that will start the civil case. But technically the civil case cannot be heard until the director of state courts makes the decision. Okay, so then once that decision is done, that will start the civil court, proceedings. But we're filing so that it becomes public record. Okay, so then you think, okay, well, that's great. You have your date in court. It's not even close to that, because now they have 28 days to respond to the complaint. And then there's scheduling, discovery, depositions. And the fast track is our day in court will be 18 months from now. That's the fast track.
Wow.
It can be 5 to 6 years. So what we want to do in the interim is create media awareness. Thankfully, the attorney, the lead attorney on this, he said, Scott, we can influence change three ways. Politically, through laws, through the court system, which is what we're doing, and media. And the thing about media is you can do it now. So I'm not putting any eggs in the legal basket, but the legal basket allows us to use media to get this out. We want to get this case out. So it'll become public record when we file the civil case. So now everybody will be able to see it.
So, and regarding the legislative egg in the basket, so to speak, with regards to laws, the case really here is that St. Elizabeth Hospital broke existing law. So you're not necessarily trying to get laws to be changed. You just want the hospital to abide and the medical staff there to abide by the laws already in place in the state and at the federal level.
Absolutely. I mean, informed consent is as basic of a law as it gets. I mean, the Nuremberg Code requires informed consent. But if you just think about how they've eroded that process over the years, so what they did, I mean, it's, you know, you go into a hospital setting, you sign that little keypad, and basically you're turning over your rights. And you don't think anything of it because you think that, well, no doctor's going to try to kill me. He's following the Hippocratic Oath. Well, I'm sure there's doctors that still are, but my experience and the experience of literally hundreds of thousands of people in the United States is that's not true anymore. They are not following the Hippocratic Oath. They have sold out to the financial gain that they get by following protocols that are not designed to keep us well. In fact, they're designed to euthanize us.
Thank you, Scott, for joining us today on the program and for sharing your story and telling us about the case. Of course, we wish you well and the best with this a lawsuit as it proceeds forward. And of course, most importantly, our prayers are with you and your family.
Wow. That was very kind, Christian, and thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And make sure you're subscribed to a robust bi-weekly print issue of The New American Magazine. You can subscribe online at thenewamerican.com or by calling 800-727-8783. Again, that's 800-727-8783. Have a good day, and we'll see you on Monday.